Hey, everybody. It's Glenn Thresh with Politico's Off Message Podcast. Focus a little bit on Hillary Clinton. You know, we've been spending so much time talking about Donald Trump. He sucks up all the oxygen in the room. And just at this point in time, it seems a hell of a lot more likely that Hillary Clinton is going to be president of the United States than Donald Trump. So it seems kind of foolish not to pay attention to who she is as an actual character. And, you know, I've covered her, as I have said ad nauseum, going on 15 years. And I've gotten to know a lot of her people and had my ups and downs with every single one of them. I mean, there's almost nobody in Clinton's inner orbit that I haven't had a knockdown, drag-out fight with and a reconciliation. And right now, my relationships are in various stages of positive and negative. We're a lot of heavens, a lot of hells. But in general, I have found the Clinton camp to be engaging. And I don't mean that sort of in the sense of that they're all kind of fun to be around. I just find that they tend to engage. They like to explain themselves. And the other characteristic that they all seem to have is a real curiosity about the woman that they work for. One of the really interesting characteristics of all the people in Clinton's orbit, Hillary Clinton's orbit, is they don't really get her. I've never come across anybody who has worked with her for a long period of time who has a complete, full picture of who the woman is. That isn't to say that they don't really understand various aspects of her personality. She's incredibly diligent. She studies a lot. She has a sharp sense of humor. But she is just somebody who has walled off areas of her personality. And I think that dovetails with a lot of the problems that she's faced, both in terms of popularity with voters and also doing things to propagate greater secrecy and less transparency. I mean, the two big issues, the two big ones that are really beating her up this cycle, the only reason why Donald Trump is within single digits in most polls is the email scandal and the Clinton Foundation issue. And both of those have their basis in this belief that Hillary Clinton has, that she deserves a quote-unquote zone of privacy around her personal and family lives. The bottom line is, this is somebody who doesn't reveal all. Brings us to my guest this week, Neera Tanden, the head of the Center for American Progress. I have known Neera for a really long time. You'll figure that out during our conversation. We have a lot of references to the various water that has flowed under various bridges in our relationship. But I don't think anybody around Hillary Clinton has as full a picture of Clinton. There are people who are closer to her personally, Huma Abedin, Cheryl Mills, even my old friend Philippe Reines, who was her longtime flack. But Neera Tanden has a very, very unique perspective on Clinton. She started working for her in the East Wing in the 1990s. Neera is a policy guru with she's got 3 feet. She's got 1 foot in policy, 1 foot in communications, and 1 foot in politics. So she's always been a little bit outside the inner sanctum of Hillary Clinton. So she's got more of a perspective on it, but she also speaks with her quite a bit, understands her ups, understands her downs, and is a ferociously pro-Hillary partisan. She's also a damn good talker, as anyone who's ever hung out with her knows. Anyway, things are going to be heating up, even though the summer is ending. We're entering September. After Labor Day, this stuff gets serious. We've got debates coming up. So I thought it'd be a really good time to get some insights into the character, the personality, and the idiosyncrasies of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now for the usual bits of business. Please follow us on iTunes and rate us. We have over 200 of them. Keep the emails coming. Been getting a lot of constructive criticism lately. Just, you know, occasionally had me reaching for that second glass of wine, but I really do appreciate it. I feel like it is character building. A lot of feedback from the UK on our Tony Blair interview that we just did, including a lot of people who felt that a lot of Labourites who feel that Jeremy Corbyn has kind of gotten away. So it was very interesting kind of going transatlantic there. So we love our listeners overseas. Keep those emails coming as well. And as usual, gthrush at politico.com. Without any further ado, here is Neera Tanden. I've covered you for a while, but I do not know your creation myth. Where are you from? Tell me, what'd your folks do? The whole nine yards.
So I grew up in Bedford, Massachusetts, which is a small town, a suburb of Boston. My parents moved there when I was really young. Bedford is not the most diverse of places. It's like 99.9% white. It was a little bit of an adjustment when I was growing up. My parents got divorced when I was 5. My father left for a time.
What do your folks do?
So my father, I think, worked in real estate. It was a little vague. And my mother had never worked a day in her life.
Really?
So she's an Indian immigrant.
What part of India?
Uttar Pradesh, so near Delhi. She grew up in Kanpur, near Delhi. Indian immigrant who found herself here in the United States with 2 little kids. I was 5 and my brother was 10 when it happened. And, you know, one day she discovered my father had sold the house and left. I mean, eventually he came back. But for the time there, we had really no idea. And so she faced a very, you know, looking back on a very tough decision because she could have gone back to India. But back in those days, people don't really get divorced in India today.
Right.
So in the mid-1970s, you know, being a woman who's divorced with 2 kids in India would have been, you know, a lot of stigma for her and for us. And so she actually chose to stay in the United States. She went on welfare. We were really, really lucky because, you know, Bedford is a very middle-class town. And it just happened that in Bedford, they were building these apartments.
Right.
And they had this law in Massachusetts which set aside, if a developer set aside low-income housing out of his units, particularly in middle.
We call them, in New York, they called it 80-20. So 80%, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so they'd speed their permit. So, you know, just as almost an accident of fate, we were able to move out of our house into an apartment. And I was able to stay in Bedford schools. Bedford schools are really phenomenal public schools. I went to elementary, junior high school in Bedford. And I actually think like if I, you know, most people in that situation have to move out of a town like that, and we were really lucky.
So you were able to at least maintain some continuity in your life.
A continuity, and also, I mean, I really had most people would have had to move to Revere or other places right. Where schools were terrible, and you know, it was weird. Like I remember being in the lunch line, and I was the only kid in. Using the voucher back then for food stamps reduced lunch, I paid 10 cents. Everyone was paying like $1.50. And I remember being at the Purity Supreme, which is our supermarket, and, you know, my mom was using the food stamps and everyone else was paying with cash. And I asked her, like, why do we have to use the funny money?
And you were different, and you started off with being different in that town anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
But, you know, I look back at it and, you know, I feel incredibly lucky that I went to school. I graduated from Bedford High School. I went to UCLA, another public school.
Right.
And then eventually, I mean, I was lucky I got into Yale Law School. But if it wasn't for being able to go to the schools, I definitely would not be where I am today.
What is your mom like? I mean, talk about like what was it like being around her when she went through all this stuff?
So my mom is very strong. Like, she's a strong-willed person. You know, she in later years, she can get overwhelmed by things. But back, you know, then, she was incredibly resilient. You right. know, she's, would say maybe some of my, should we say, assertiveness comes
yes.
from comes from my mom.
I've heard that described several different ways.
That's on my good days.
On your good days.
I think she had a kind of confidence to be able to match that because, she was weathering a lot of storms. Her first job was actually at it was within the Indian community. They were back when we actually had travel agents. She
right.
worked at an Indian travel agent's office, but then eventually got a job at Raytheon. And, you know, within 6 years, she was actually able to buy a house
wow.
in Bedford, Massachusetts.
Wow.
which was amazing, you know, and you know, I think about, like, she's a single woman and went through all that and was able to get a very middle income job and buy her own house, be a homeowner within a couple of years. And, you know, I mean, it sounds completely, I appreciate, sappy, but, you know, that was really, I'm only here because I had obviously a mom who's capable of, who was that committed to her kids and that strong, but also, you know, a lot of people, you know, what people would describe as bureaucrats, a lot of bureaucrats made a series of decisions to try to ensure that a kid in my situation could live her potential.
Because I've covered people who've been in these kind of situations, and you know this too. The people who tend to...
You know, reporters even have these situations.
My father was unemployed for not an insignificant part of my childhood, and he, everyone accuses me of talking too much about this stuff, but my dad fell from a ladder. He had his own contracting business, fell off a ladder, broke both of his heels, and was out of work for 6 months, and we were in very bad shape. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I had a version of that, not with the family disintegration.
Yeah.
But the level of stress internally on a family.
Mm-hmm.
How did people, you mentioned sort of being the only one with the school lunch voucher. How did people treat you? Did they treat you any differently?
You know, I have to say, when I look back at it now, and, you know, I felt very separate from other kids. But I actually don't know if it was because I was, like, the only brown kid,
yeah.
You know, or because of that. And that changed, like, when I got into high school and stuff. But my initial feelings, like, at recess was feeling kind of separate. And I honestly don't know if it was because of, you know, being the only kid, like, using the food stamps. I don't think kids were really aware of it. I was definitely very aware of it, but I don't remember anyone else. I mean, maybe someone asked me occasionally, like, what are you using that for? But I didn't feel like that. I did feel very different. I mean, also, you know, we weren't a super Orthodox Hindu family or anything, but, you know, it was, people wore different clothes, et cetera,
right,
on occasion. And I felt really different. But I would say Bedford overall was pretty welcoming. Like, I get, like, some stupid things people would say and at recess, but very rarely. And, you know, I felt overall like the town was pretty cool and open-minded.
So obviously,
of course, Massachusetts is pretty
progressive.
Open-minded and pretty progressive.
The so in terms of you went to UCLA and you went to Yale Law School and Yale is a pretty progressive law school. I know a couple of people who went there. So do you?
Yeah, we all know a few people who went there.
What is it? So I mean, it seems like a fairly linear progression from having gone through that as a kid to being interested in this kind of policy. I mean, tell me how you kind of, you really carved out a career in policy at all levels. What sort of...
Well, my mom, I have to say, one of my earliest memories of my mom is her jumping up and down in our little apartment when Jimmy Carter won. I mean, he actually, it was late at our time, and my mom and I shared a bedroom. So I was like, what are you doing? And she was so overwhelmed with happiness when Jimmy Carter won his election. And she definitely, you know, she's very interested in politics. She definitely was mindful of, you know, Democrats, mm-hmm, and not just support of the safety net, but for, you know, support of immigrants and people who are different. I remember when I was in sixth grade, Ronald Reagan won, and I went through this whole, like, pro-Ronald Reagan thing, and I watched his State of the Union.
Pro-Ronald Reagan thing?
I know, it was very, you know, caught up in the emotion of the new president, and my mom was like, you know, he's for prayer in school, which would be a little awkward for us.
Right.
And then I, you know, thought a little bit more critically and came off that high.
I hear President Obama was admiring of him at a later point in his career, right?
Oh, let's not poke at these things, shall we? So she really instilled in me, again, sounds totally hokey, but, like, she really instilled in me this idea that matters who the president is, it actually affects people, like, the people can spend their time. People make decisions every day in government, whether you're going to help or sometimes hurt people. And I mean, I didn't really think of it at the time. It occurred to me later. But, like, you know, I used, we used, like, almost every government program, like Section 8 housing and food stamps. And
you had, oh, you lunch. Did. You had a Section 8 voucher.
Yeah, we used a Section 8 voucher. So it was like that. There was the Massachusetts law, but then there was also the ability to pay for that low-income housing. So
I don't think people have any idea the importance of Section 8.
Yeah.
I think people think of public housing as public housing. They have no idea that Section 8 is really the glue that holds a lot of
things together. And so much bigger and serves so many more people. Yep. And made so much. And that made all the difference for us. And, you know, and it's just my so my own experience. Again, we live in very cynical times and people are always like, nobody in Washington does anything. But, you know, I'm only here today because a bunch of people in the 1960s decided to try to address poverty in the United States and created a series of programs that helped me get to where I am. You know, the issue I worked on, the first issue and the biggest issue I worked on in the Clinton administration was a giant child care package.
Which was the issue, the main issue with, which is the, okay, so let's get
to it. And that child care package, you know, in President Clinton's mind,
that was
in
the
a
linchpin.
Lot of people's mind was past, you know, we have to invest more in child care. So parents, particularly low-income parents, particularly women who would be on welfare, wouldn't have to face that trade-off of a child at home with no one caring for him or her and working. And so the child care package was actually designed to at least address some of the needs of low-income women who face that child care issue. And, you know, I should just note in the, you know, President Clinton has acknowledged recently there are problems with the welfare bill. The five-year time limit was which did not take account for recessions. And,
right.
And CAP has done a lot of important work on some of the limits of the welfare bill.
So did you have interactions with Hillary Clinton on this? Because there have been various accounts on this, but she was pretty supportive of President Clinton's vetoes, right? And has she said that she publicly supported the passage of the final bill, but she's expressed some trepidation.
Well, so
about
this was the interesting thing. You know, like, I worked with Hillary. We never did any work on welfare bill. It was completely separate. Obviously, she focused a lot on health care and a whole range of issues I'd ever worked on. Hillary was just not involved in the welfare bill and welfare implementation. And, you know, there are a lot of people who worked for her at the time who had a lot of concerns about it, you know. And I remember talking to Milan about it. And
Milan
Verveer, who was her chief of staff. And, you know, there were a lot of people who had qualms. So I never actually spoke directly with Hillary about this in any time around it. But it, you know, it was just clearly not one of the issues she had spent any time working on from, you know, post the welfare bill passage.
So in terms of you first meeting her, what was your first impression of her? When was the first time you ever met her?
So I started in November of 97. And within a couple of weeks, we had a meeting, a kind of policy meeting with her. And I still remember it was a Friday. And we used to have the meetings, policy meetings with her in her dining room. So that meant going up into the White House and, you know, you go up the elevator and, you know, I was definitely floored. I was like, but, you know, here she was. So in that meeting, we were going over a bunch of issues and like what things she should really focus on. And I started talking. She wanted to go to Boston, and there was a bunch of issues around juvenile crime. And I started talking to her about Boston's community policing program. And
Bill Bratton was involved in that, wasn't he?
I don't think he was at that time.
Okay.
Anyway, Boston had had a long history of real racial strife between the communities.
Yep.
Between communities. And this is in the late 1990s, but there was a lot of research being done about how they had effectively lowered crime rates and also done a lot to kind of soothe tensions.
Right.
And, you know, after the busing incidents of the 70s, et cetera, that was, you know, there was a lot of focus on that. And my, you know, so I'm 27 years old and I'm talking to Hillary Clinton about these issues. And she's, you know, she was like totally engaged, you know, we then talked about how maybe she should go visit some of these programs. And within a year, we were doing big events on... Now, a series of things happened in the country. We had a bunch of incidents around police shootings and juvenile crime issues were spiking. We had an all-day conference she really led on. So, you know, my experience with her was she's really down to earth. You know, she's like a totally, like, I was very, very nervous. I was like in my best suit, super nervous, and then continually telling myself not to be nervous. And just be confident. And but she, you know, she engaged in ideas. She really tries to get ideas from everyone around the table, like, you know, from the newest person to the person she's been with for a long time, and takes her ideas seriously and is, you know, really funny. I mean, that's the thing that's so weird. I mean, everyone says this in every interview, but what is so weird about it is all the discussions about, like, an armor and everything. You know, first of all, she does... And I've seen her in other meetings really try to disarm people who are nervous by making them comfortable. And she's really, like, hysterically funny. I mean, she just has this kind of can be a sarcastic sense of humor.
Give me an example of a really sarcastic thing that she says.
I don't know. This might get in trouble. I think it's okay to say this.
Yeah,
let's
go for it.
So, you know, first of all, the really good thing with Hillary is that, you know, there are a few people in the White House who could poke fun at President Clinton. And, you know, I remember going into this briefing and Al Gore and Hillary were waiting for President Clinton to come because, like, the event obviously can't start till he's there, and it was, like, with all of them. And he was 15 minutes late, and Gore started off by saying, well, we're, like, this is like being early for, like, a Bill Clinton event. And Hillary was like, you know, are people going to be there? Are they going to even think we're there? Because, like, we're actually only 15 minutes late. Which was pretty funny, or at least funny at the time.
I think it was funny.
You know, she has a very kind of wry sense of the world. And, you know, even when things are kind of, I mean, having lived through the things she's lived through, you know, you know, she has a sense of when things are up and down. And so when things are, you know, when it seems like the world is kind of collapsing for mere mortals, you know, like headlines, she's much more upbeat about, like, getting through it and, like, this too shall pass. And then also when things are, like, seem like they're really great, she's also like, you know, it could go the other way. We should recognize that as well.
Well, I mean, I've heard some things. I mean, I've written a lot of stuff on campaign coverage that sometimes she could.
You've covered herself. You've covered her a lot yourself.
I have covered her a lot myself. But I mean, I've reported that there have been times when things perhaps aren't going that well on the campaign where maybe Neera, she isn't quite as upbeat as you've just described. I mean, look, she's got an edge, right? She's a person who has a little bit of an edge.
So here's my thing with her, which is that, you know, she's a strong person, super capable person. You definitely, you know, she has a really good BS detector.
Yeah.
So, like, in your policy meeting, you know, if you don't have your kind of act together on all the main points, she's likely to know, you know, she's likely to be able to see that gray area where you're, you know, you're kind of, people are kind of fudging it a little bit, which is actually, I think, a really helpful thing, but actually also can be discomforting to people because, you know, she's on it. She's not like, you know, I think she actually spends time trying to make people comfortable in, like, these settings, but, you know,
okay,
she's
but
a
why?
Serious person.
So here's a big question that everyone always asks, which is how come there's that large a disconnect between her capacity to project that in public and her ability to do it in private? I mean, like, why is it that there is this perception? Look, we were just looking at her speech, right? She's a different kind of speech giver than she is when she's around a table. Like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, you know, I mean, a lot of candidates have, you know, it's like there's just a four-lane highway. It's like going up the mountain is like a four-lane highway where it's like you get a lot of room to maneuver and people kind of give you the benefit of the doubt. And she's just lived in a world for a very long time where, you know, it's not like every paragraph is digested and redigested. It's like every phrase and where the comma is. And also, you know, there is this tendency with coverage of her to like ascribe motivation to everything. And it's just hard to live in that world where every element of everything you do is parsed and be like super comfortable.
Some people can get away with it. I mean, you have a candidate now in Donald Trump who got away with it for a long time. And do you think it's
did he really get away with it? I don't know. I mean, I guess the thing is, like, she's a very serious person, and you know, and her sense of humor is one that can be a little sarcastic too, and it's not, you know, it's not clear. I don't know. It is a mystery. And I think it's, you know, I do think you see it occasionally, but it is hard. It's hard to like let everything out there when everything does get open to misinterpretation.
If we're looking at this from the longer view of history, how much of this do you think has to do with gender? Like
I think a lot of it has to do with gender. Just the other day, a reporter was like, basically, like, Hillary's the worst candidate and she's terrible and I've never met anybody.
But you push back on me just fine.
It wasn't Glenn Frey.
Wow.
It was not Glenn Frey.
It was a copycat.
He has a British accent. Anyway, it was terrible, but, you know, she's going to win anyway. And I just asked. I was like, who is the female candidate you think is just really knocks your socks off?
Interesting.
And I had, like, it was a dead silence for a minute there. I mean, I think there are people you could think of, actually, who are pretty good. But, like, you know, just silence.
Barbara Mikulski.
I love Barbara Mikulski.
Of course you do. You love everybody.
I love everybody. I don't love everybody. But well,
I had a really interesting exchange with John Dickerson a couple of weeks ago where he essentially said, you know, women don't give – I don't want to over-paraphrase this because I would like occasionally to be on the Tiffany Network. But
So are you calling John Dickerson a sexist?
Absolutely not. Okay.
I tweet that?
He did shut up. He did say that he thought, can you name women who have given, apart from Eleanor Roosevelt, who have given great speeches?
And also, let's just be clear, Eleanor Roosevelt in her time was criticized for being a terrible speaker.
She's a terrible, like, talk about shouty.
I mean, it's not like people were like, in comparison to her husband and almost everyone else, she was described as a terrible speaker.
Right, but there does seem to be, I mean, there seems to be at least out there that perception, you know?
Yeah, and you know, the thing, like, but so let's, I'll try to be optimistic. I do think a lot of it is gendered, but I would say, you know, one of the big differences between today and, say, the 08 campaign is that a lot of the things that are more sexist are definitely, or feel more gendered, are definitely getting called out in a way that they just weren't.
Oh, like what?
Like, you know, I mean, Hillary gives a speech, you know, gives a speech after Bernie Sanders.
Right.
In which, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Bernie Sanders, but that guy is definitely yelling throughout, right, like, his entire speeches. And looks also kind of angry. It's not like he's, like, smiley face speaker, right? He's definitely, like, I mean, and it works. It works for his audience, et cetera. But he's the person who is definitely yelling without a smile. Okay.
Right.
And then she would do a speech and everyone's like, she's yelling. I
got into big trouble for saying that she was shouting at a speech. At all, the power, the hounds of hell came down on me on that one. But I mean,
and
look,
I would just say hounds of hell, also known as the conscience of a nation.
The conscience of a nation.
But you know, you see more and more women. I mean, at least today, 8 years ago, I mean, I don't need to relitigate it, but there were cable people who were like, would say she's a bitch or the B word.
Right.
I hope that doesn't.
Look, you see it in Cleveland, there were these T-shirts that were. In New Hampshire. Monica Lewinsky T-shirt.
And in New Hampshire, you know, wash my shirts. Was it wash or iron my shirts? Oh, guys, you showed up saying iron
that's
my
right.
shirts.
But the one, you know, the one I remember was the, and I like her as a writer, the Robin Givens story.
Yeah.
Which was about, was it the necklines, the sexy Hillary story?
The necklines.
Which was really
the
gross.
The cleavage.
It was gross.
It was like, what?
I mean, like,
it's also like one of those things, like, really?
There are male candidates from this cycle who have impressive cleavage too, and no one talks about them. I can name a couple. I will not name a couple.
Are you taking pictures with the shirt?
We do. It's a lovely shirt.
So, but so I think that's, I think the culture has changed in that a lot of the things that happened in 08 are not happening in the same way. At least they get called out. There is a group of people, like when men are like, oh, she's shouting and, you know, she seems angry. Maybe we have more women journalists or more conscious people are more conscious. The culture is more conscious.
Was there a real Bernie Bros phenomenon, or was that just in the heat of battle kind of thing?
Have you checked my Twitter feed?
I'm asking you to give me. I'm asking for an out loud version of your Twitter feed.
Here's what I would say. You know what I was really fascinated about, and in the primary, was a kind of focus on class to the exclusion of all other things, really championed, I think, a lot by a lot of white men.
Right.
And now you could say that class is the defining issue over everything else, or, you know, more traditionally amongst progressives, I will say for myself, I definitely, you know, I'm proud of all the work we've done on inequality. I definitely see class as a major issue in the United States, but not to the exclusion of racism or sexism. And I think that, you know, at a kind of fundamental level, what we were actually debating was class over everything else. And there were definitely, you know,
Sanders' answer about sort of when he was talking about sort of didn't he sort of bring a slavery answer back to Wall Street?
Yes, he talked about, yeah. I mean, you know, he, in the beginning of the campaign, definitely preferenced economic issues and tried to, in the beginning, actually tried to make race much more about economics versus just racism.
Right.
And, you know,
which,
and
by
I
the
think,
way, is very European, which, having just been over in the UK, that's a very European way to look at things because they mute the racial stuff.
Yes. And, you know, I do think, like, there were definitely people who would criticize me and points I would make by using terms that had, I thought, been more identified with the right, like identitarianism or like identity politics. And so I think that there was a definite, and there was definitely like a kind of anger and vitriol online, which was really surprising. I mean, there were definitely people from the left who were telling me to like die or, you know, terrible things. So I don't want to say, I definitely am not saying, like, and before people go crazy on Twitter, I'm not saying that like every Bernie Sanders supporter is Bernie bro or anything like that. But I do think that I think the kind of unsettled thing in the primary, you know, every primary is actually having this kind of substantive debate about the leadership of the party or where it's going.
Right.
And I think the real truth in the party, the debates was, I mean, I think actually one of the reasons why Hillary won the primary or was a pivot point for her was to say very clearly out loud, you know, I totally agree on these economic issues that inequality is a paramount concern.
Right.
But that is not our only problem. You know, we also face a problem of racism. And I think her kind of an underreported thing in the primary was her speech on, you know, it was on racism where she talked about systemic racism and institutionalized racism as a white person and the need for white people to understand what that feels like for people of color. I thought it was, you know, I mean, I thought it was, no white politician has talked that way about race in my adult lifetime or in my lifetime. So, and I thought that was an incredibly important moment, and that she did it first.
Now, in 08, we were both in South Carolina. I don't know if you spent a lot of time in South Carolina.
I was just there. I was so privileged to just be there for that
debate. That was a quite an experience.
That was definitely a debate.
That was a scarring, particularly for Bill Clinton, I think, mm-hmm. being called out on racial issues. It was a really tough moment for these guys. To what extent, personally, and you talk, we should, I think it is openly known that you speak with Hillary Clinton from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent was that South Carolina experience this time a vindication? I mean, how did she personally feel about being able to reconnect with black voters?
I think her victory in South Carolina this time was amongst of the last year, one of the most important psychological boosts. And because of what happened 8 years ago, because of the timing of it, you know, came after some harder fought races in Iowa and New Hampshire. Because, you know, just the actual day-to-day campaigning, she just felt a sense of warmth and acceptance and love. And, you know, I think the truth is, particularly psychologically, you know, the kind of connection she felt, particularly with African-American women around issues
the
of
guns, right?
Guns, but like just grit and resilience, you know, like kind of, you know, people having a respect for like her pushing through a lot of things. Like she definitely deals with a lot of crap. And
do you think black women get her more than other people do?
African-American women have been her strongest supporters in this primary. I think that I think with women of color, there's a kind of like, I know what it's like to get crapped on.
I mean, that's right.
I know what it's like to get everyone kind of being against you and pushing through it and getting up and living and like still being there day to day to day to day. And some of the roundtables and just interchanges she's had with women of color who like on child care and other issues that people are dealing with, I think have been like the most resonant for her. And so I think South Carolina was hugely important. I think the difficulty 8 years ago was, Hillary Clinton is a person who in every job she's ever had has had, you know, incredible diversity around her. She's like had women of color who lead for her. Cheryl Mills and Patty Sleasdoyle and me. You know, I've never seen, and I've been watching a long time. She's always had the most diverse staff. And the idea, she seeks that out. She seeks out people who have different life experiences. And she's like recognized from, you know, the 90s that who's at the table really matters for what's getting discussed. And what policies are going to actually happen. And so I think it really kind of wounded her that people would think that she had any kind of prejudice in mind at all. And it wounded both of them, but it definitely wounded her.
In terms of, let's talk about 08 for a little while. that was not clearly as positive an experience, and you were there for every twist and turn in this thing.
Sadly.
I was up in that office. I still remember your office in Ballston was next to Howard Wolfson's office, and I will never forget seeing there was a fist-shaped hole in Howard's wall.
Not in mine. The time that it actually happened was quite surprising.
And then there was the, tell me about that.
No.
Well, then tell me all the Phil Singer stories. I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah, no.
You're not going to tell me any of those either. Wow. Then we have nothing to talk about. What?
Okay. Great.
You've seen her. How is she different as a candidate? What were her? You've said all these incredibly nice things about her. What were her shortcomings? What do you think she learned from 08? What do you think she did wrong that she did right this time?
I think the most important thing was that this campaign is definitely, you know, it's had rocky moments, and you know she's kept calm throughout those rocky moments. And I think that is
I should say my reporting varies somewhat from your account entirely
this time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that she's kept things can unravel and get people a little uptight. But, you know, she obviously has had a lot more stability with the staff.
Did she make a decision to sort of keep, because my sense of 08 compared to this time, much more tactile involvement with the staff, a lot more.
Yeah, that seems true.
Seems like she
put. I mean, I'm not on the staff this time.
Right, but it seems, case in point. But it seems now that she kind of put a bit of distance, a little bit of a buffer between her and the day-to-day operations of the campaign. That seems to have
in
been.
In 08?
No, now.
Well, I would say that in 08, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that issue very well because I'm not there day to day.
Right.
Here. I mean, now.
But I'm talking about the conference call phenomenon in 08, the endless conference calls.
Oh, well, the truth of that is, and this is always a challenge, which is, you know, it's hard, it's easier to see the flaws when you've lost. You know, the endless conference calls really happened when no one had any idea how to win the race.
Right.
And so, you know, we had endless conference calls to kind of figure out what to do.
Right.
And so...
Because you really didn't know. I mean, like, there really was a moment there.
I mean, and, you know, as we were heading into, you know, in November and December of in Iowa, ahead of Iowa, when her numbers started, like, heading significantly downwards.
After the debate, Drexel,
after
right?
After the Philadelphia debate, yep. And her numbers were just, you know, people were like... I remember being on conference calls saying, so what's our kind of strategy for the next month, and getting answers back amongst the advisors, yeah. Of, you know, win the endorsement of the newspaper, and then that will help us win, which did not seem at the time to me to be the absolute assurance of victory.
You did get the Register endorsement, as I recall.
Yes, and actually still lost Iowa, oddly enough. Shoot.
Yeah.
You know, I think the truth is that she's learned a lot of lessons. Like, the team gets along better. People are nicer to each other, which is, you know, not unimportant.
Right.
There isn't, you know, that in 08 you had one advisor who controlled the
Mark Penn
who controlled the strategy for the entire race. And the challenge with that kind of scenario is that when that person does not have, you know, is wrong about something, then it becomes a much bigger deal.
Like the general direction of the party, for instance.
Like how, you know, the Democratic primary in Iowa and New Hampshire is very progressive. People
right.
are very
right.
liberal. They're, you know, on both sides, they're not as far right as the Republican primary is, but they're very liberal.
But here's one thing in 08 that wasn't really present. Now, look, the attacks that Obama made were generational attacks. If anything, you could sort of accuse him of ageism. Like, the implication was her judgment on the Iraq War and the fact that she was yesterday's news. We did not see those resonant attacks on trust. Curiously enough, that was stuff that was really more in the early 90s. That was not a big fundamental.
No, I mean, there were sort of, you know, there was like a kind of, I mean, I certainly do not want to litigate the 08 campaign
right.
because I just want to say I like everybody.
Right.
But, you know, there was a kind of resonant or a subtle like trust issue, but it wasn't.
Not like this.
No. This primary is much tougher on. You know, these kind of much more open attacks on, you know, being bought and paid for and all that stuff, you know, Senator Sanders prosecuted a much tougher character attack. And I actually have to say, I think he brought a lot of really important issues to the fore, but he did do significant damage to Hillary's negatives. I mean, he drove a lot of those negatives. And the truth of it, I mean, just to be candid or honest about it, it's, you know, I think getting those kinds of attacks from another Democrat or another liberal or another progressive is much tougher for Hillary. And it was really hard. If you look at her trust numbers, they, you know, the last 6 months of that primary was those numbers took a much sharper dive and been hard to recover from. But she's, you know, as the convention did do a fair amount of work on that space, though.
But you, Neera Tanden, I presume that you didn't have anything to do with the setting up of the email server. I mean, there has been, she does have this tendency. Now, you did know.
Oh, for the love of Christ. Really? Are you kidding?
I thought you were Hindu. But I mean, like the...
Don't, are we done?
No, you've got a couple more minutes left of the interrogation. We did the nice stuff, you know.
Yeah, okay, great.
It's called the hard close. No, but seriously, like, to what extent is some of this stuff self-inflicted? I mean...
What stuff?
The email server.
Okay, she's... I mean, I think we've all acknowledged... I mean, I don't know. Should I get a tattoo myself of saying it was a mistake?
Right.
We shouldn't have done it.
Let me frame the question another way, because because in addition to being a policy,
I mean, if the question is, are any of these attacks self-inflicted? Another way of saying that is, has she made any mistakes? Has Hillary made mistakes? Sure, she's made mistakes.
Right.
She's, because no politician or no person is perfect.
Right.
I just think that the challenge of this is that we kind of lose perspective. I mean, I'm certainly not like, there's no criticism to be made. It's just like, let's put them in the perspective of like the life a person's lived and what they've done. And the weird thing about it, this whole like, I've been on a kind of ride along with Hillary for 20 years. And what's weird about it is, this is what Hillary does. You know, I've been in a lot of the decisions she's made as a senator, as a candidate, as a first lady. She really is like, how's this policy going to work? Is it going to help people? Is it going to hurt people? Is it going to help more people than hurt people? You know, I mean, her way she looks at these things is not some crazy Lady Macbeth way of like, what will this do? It really is like,
she did say,
am I going to help people?
She did say, out, out, damn spot in the Drexel debate, right? But wait, you have a personal
kill them all. What's weird about it, this is what I've never understood about her. You know, like, the space she rents in people's heads. Like, she's a person. She's a normal person. She laughs. She cries.
Dude,
like,
she is not.
She's not normal. Okay, maybe more normal is overstated. But, you know, she's like. But it's not. You know, the thing that kills me about the coverage of her is just like every little. You know, the number of times on a campaign for her when I've worked on something where. Everyone's like, this was the grand theory of how to do this thing.
Hey, I got a crazy idea how you might want to solve that. I just want to give you a suggestion.
Can I just finish the sentence?
I am sorry.
For the podcast?
Yes.
It's that she, you know, I mean, it's a ubiquitous thing in the coverage that she's got some grand Lady Macbeth strategy of how to do something. And really, it's just like it happened. And sometimes it was like a mistake or something. And like this, you know, no one was sending any crazy message. That's more often true than not. But there's always like this kind of layer of suspicion to everything.
Well, you know.
For a person who honestly, I mean, truthfully, is really just trying to think about like what, you know, look at her policies.
The one suggestion
there's a modality.
There's a way. How about having just suggest an off-the-record conversation with a reporter from now?
You know
what
I think she should do?
What?
Is she should do a podcast with Glenn Thrush. That's what I think she should do. Oh, look, she did that. Ooh.
Okay, I'm sorry. But, you know, I would say spread the wealth. Two more questions and then I'll let you go. In terms of the you have seen a difference in the temperature, though, because you hooked on what I think people don't remember is that towards the end of the OA campaign, didn't you kind of jump over to the Obama campaign with Patty Sully Stoyle at the end?
I did.
What was the difference between the way you thought Obama was being treated and the way Hillary was? Because you got to actually experience
that. I think you asked the president a great question on this in his podcast.
you're doing bang up business here. But do you have any experiences that kind of reminded you of like, I'm teeing you up here.
I got to the Obama campaign and within 2 weeks, there was a national reporter who was like hanging out, you know, at the headquarters and like walking
Prudential
around
Plaza,
talking to people.
Chicago.
Yes. In Chicago, in the high rise and walking around and, you know, comes up to me and starts chatting. And then, like, we're walking. He's, like, walking out of the building at the same time I am. And he turns to me and is like, don't you just feel lucky to be here? and you know, I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, you get to, like, be here with Barack Obama. I was like, you know, I was like, Barack Obama is definitely pretty cool. But I was like, okay, like that's kind of weird. I mean, it literally was like you're breathing the air with these other people.
Maybe that's why. Did you ever think she was going to run again?
I did not think she was going to run again then at all.
Why?
I mean, because if you like back then, it just seemed like she was so defeated, and he was so, I mean, I didn't think she was going to be named Secretary of State. I didn't know, think any of those really? Things. I thought, I mean, you know, there was a fair amount of animosity between the campaigns. And I remember when I got to his campaign, like a lot, I really did feel in the beginning, I think I could say this. I really felt at the beginning a little bit like I was wearing a scarlet letter H. Like, I was like, you know, the person who
carrying,
worked for
carrying
Hillary.
A virus.
And truthfully, like Obama was, I said this to Hillary later. I was like, Barack Obama was like, actually like really nice, as was Pete Rouse and Anita Dunn and other people eventually. But when
how
I
was
first
Dan
got
Pfeiffer?
There, Dan Pfeiffer was great. He was great.
Pluff.
He was fine. He was fine. He was fine. There were some other people, but I'm not going to mention all of them. But anyway, he and I think, you know, the primary was definitely hard fought. And I've actually thought back about that now, which is, as you know, Hillary's won. You know, I do think that you have to figure out how you unite the party. And I worked on the platform committee, and I worked on a lot of, I mean, it was one of Hillary's appointments to the Democratic Platform Committee. And I thought really consciously about areas where we could actually try to come together, you know, on a bunch of issues that Sanders spoke passionately about. And, you know, we made a lot of progress. Or the platform itself reflects, you know, she did win, so probably more of her. But there's a lot of Senator Sanders' ideas, from Glass-Steagall to college, that are reflected in the platform.
What about the accusation? And it's, you know, she changed pretty radically on TPP. First of all, do you think that she is truly against it?
Yes. I mean, this is what's crazy. So this is the thing
Terry
being
McAuliffe
with Hillary
has told a colleague of mine that we might see.
I think he rescinded that quickly.
No.
Well, we'll see. I mean, actually, I feel totally confident saying this. We'll see. You know, so this is the issue with being with Hillary for a long time. I mean, I worked for Hillary in the late 1990s. I worked for her as a senator when she was a senator. I was a legislative director. I was her legislative director for a time. You know, Hillary has always been more squeamish on trade than other people in the other Democrats. She voted against she voted against CAFTA, which was a multilateral trade deal she had. But also, more importantly, you know, she's thought and done speeches on, you know, the downsides of trade, how there are winners and losers in trade, how the world is reacting, you know, how what China's role is and how it is actually unfair. And she was doing that. You know, she talked about those issues in our last presidential race, the rise of state-owned enterprises. I was disadvantaging manufacturers.
She's very tough on China.
Very tough on China in 08. And
the lead toys, I remember.
You know, talked about a whole series of issues. In fact, you know, it was pretty progressive on economic issues.
But
her
she clearly supported. She clearly, come on.
Yes, no. And I'm saying, she championed, she was Secretary of State. She championed a framework around trade between the United States and Asia. You know, it is just the case that she left and the trade deal, Mike Froman was working for the last 2 years to actually get a trade deal articulated. So, you know, but that was like a kind of perfect example of the just assumption that she has always been like a free trader her whole life. And you know, there are people who worked on NAFTA who will tell you that she was always was ambivalent about NAFTA and was arguing, why are we pushing NAFTA in the beginning of this administration, et cetera. But, you know, it's kind of the thing. I mean, what's so interesting to me about the primary and the attacks on Hillary as kind of a, you know, moderate DLCer is, like, I worked for Hillary in the 1990s in the Clinton White House, where other people in the White House who were the centrists were like, hide the ball from Hillary.
On what issues?
You know, I mean, I remember working on gun issues, and there were like other people in the White House who didn't want me to go to a meeting because they didn't want Hillary to know about it, because they didn't want us to talk about, you know, the whole range of issues, you know, not just being tough on crime, but like how we're actually helping juveniles and the juvenile system. And you know, we would be planning a conference and Hillary'd be like, let's also get, if we're talking about, you know, what's happening with juveniles and why they're turning towards criminal justice, let's actually try to understand what's happening. Like, let's get some child psychologists and let's, and like, it can't all be about law and order, you know? And so, you know, what's so interesting about how the world moves is like 20 years ago, Hillary was essentially accused by the right of being a socialist. And, you know, like I vividly remember issues in which like the Treasury Department was like, why is the First Lady's office even thinking about something like this without, you know, because they were worried that a liberal in the White House would wreck it for them.
Talk with Tony Blair a couple of days ago, and Blair said to me that he suggested that she was the last great hope of centrism in the West. Do you think she's the last?
I don't really think Tony Blair has an adequate sense of Hillary's views on every issue.
So you don't think she's that? Well, one last thing, and that's we haven't talked much about Trump. maybe I'll just say Trump. To what extent? Well, first of all, I have known you to be a very nervous consumer of polling data over the years. How are you feeling?
I mean, sometimes very justifiably.
How are you feeling right now? I mean, do you feel reasonably confident that she's going to win this thing?
Well, I mean, I'm a Democrat, so I definitely think that we should be a Democrat personally, because I do run a think tank. But I think that it looks pretty good at this moment. I mean, I think you should never take anything for granted. But if you look at the broad trend lines, I think people in politics underestimate how views get locked. And I think some of the views are getting kind of locked by now.
About Trump, you mean?
I think the most fundamental question that will affect politics for the next 20 years is how Republicans respond to this occurrence.
Meaning,
you know, you could see, I mean, I'd like to think that if a Donald Trump happened to the Democratic Party, I would spend a considerable amount of time thinking, like, what went wrong?
Right.
What did we do? What happens? And I think Trump is a real response to rising inequality in the country and a lot of people not having the economic, having a positive economic outlook, but also driven in large measure by, you know, intense nativism. But another factor really is that Washington's dysfunction. And I think that's a big question going forward is, you know, if everyone does the same thing they've been doing, what happens to both parties? I think the Democratic Party is a lot more stable. But, you know, I mean, I think, like, you know, I mean, if you'd said to me in 2014 that this where we are is, you know, we'd be here with the Republican Party, I would have been really surprised.
I wouldn't. I mean, I mean, if you observe the Tea Party thing on the Hill. But my final question, which is, things are looking okay right now. Identify for me the one or two things that could happen to upset the trajectory of the race right now.
Well, the most important, the largest question is whether Trump normalizes, which I think is just getting hard for him to do. I mean, there is a lot of anger at Washington being incapable of solving problems, and that was his root.
Right.
And his root was being the person who could change Washington for the better. I just think that has become harder, in that he has a long track record of being erratic, and, you know, things can get changed for the worse.
Right.
You know, exogenous events could affect them. I have to say, I was really taken with how the WikiLeaks email right ahead of the convention very much like played with the psychology of Sanders supporters and others. You know, I mean, obviously what happened at the DNC was outrageous,
right,
and stupid, and I'm glad they're taking a series of steps,
right,
to change that all throughout the organization, but didn't actually show any evidence of like changing votes or anything. And yet we live in such a cynical time that people do just believe the worst.
So you think like a WikiLeaks dump or something like that could have a significant impact?
I mean, I think something like that could happen. I mean, you have to remember that October surprises go in all directions. And I'm old enough to remember in 1992 that right before the election, George Bush there was a big hit on Bush. Yeah. So, I'm not losing sleep over some exogenous event happening. Hillary is also the one thing that's in Hillary's favor is that if like some massive disruption happens in the world, she's the strong and stable leader in the race, not Trump. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily hurt her when, you know, something crazy happens in the world.
Which wasn't necessarily the case earlier on in the race before people's opinions were locked in, right?
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, it depends on what it is, but people think she's more stable in a national security crisis, for example, just because of her experience as Secretary of State than, say, him. So you if something happens in the world, I don't expect it to necessarily, like, hurt her.
I lied. One last question. Do you think that there really is –
he lies all the time. Whatever.
Do you think there – a number of people have sent me emails suggesting I call this one last question. I have heard from a number of people in your general universe that there is a genuine concern that they do believe that there is a Putin-Trump axis and that there is a real concerted effort on the part of the, you know, whatever, Assange, Putin, Manafort, the whole. Do you think that there really is sort of a conspiracy going on?
I don't think it's a conspiracy. I mean, I think, like, if you do research, and not research, there, if you're in Europe, the Russians are openly funding the far right groups, you know, from UKIP, Marie Le Pen, ADP in Germany. There is widespread knowledge among center left parties that is a rising development that they are dealing with. If you look at RT, Russia Today, you know, I mean, it's a fascinating thing. Recommend people do it. The amount of time they spend propping up the third parties in the United States, the amount of time they spend attacking Hillary in, you know, in ways that are just very aligned with the arguments of the Trump campaign. So I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. I think that Russia is in the number of trips people have made to Russia, you know, they do these free trips. I think every foreign government has an interest in American politics, and Russia has a history of playing in European politics, and we should not be surprised if they are attempting to do the same here.
What can be done about that? Are we dealing with issues of legality? Are we dealing with, or do we just let it kind of roll?
Well, I actually think this like Trump's flirtations and not even flirtations, and swimming with the alt-right, it's like we just have to have more information about it. And you know, it does disturb Americans to think Russians are involved in our elections. It is a distressing thing, and we just need to raise it. I think what is so weird is, and kind of odd given Russia's human rights history, the number of people on the left who like knee-jerk want to say that doesn't exist. I mean, it's very bizarre. It's not like red baiting. They're not communists. They're like, if anything, Russia is a proto-fascist country right now. He's basically like, you know, killing or silencing opposition. It's not.
Do you think Putin is actually afraid of Hillary in terms of?
I think Putin is definitely not a fan of Hillary Clinton's. In his own rhetoric, Hillary was very, very clear in her condemnation of his actions towards democracy protesters. She was very strong, and he took that as a very strong affront.
So no more reset buttons. Anyway, Neera Tanden, thank you for taking the time.
Great to be with you.